Welcome to the podcast, Agia Goes Viral. We here at the Arab-German Young Academy of Sciences and Humanities, Agia for short, invite you to join us as we explore the diverse implications of COVID-19 for science and society at large. In each episode, Arab and German Agia members and alumni from different scientific disciplines come together to discuss research on and amidst the coronavirus pandemic. In today's podcast episode, we welcome two Agia alumni, Professor Julia Hauser from Germany and Professor Bilal Orfali from Lebanon, who discuss the implications of COVID-19 on research in the humanities. Julia focuses on the history of masks and the public perception of facial covering in Europe, while Bilal illustrates how Sufi practices and Islamic mystical traditions can offer spiritual guidance in times of crisis. Julia Hauser is Junior Professor of Global History at the University of Kassel. Bilal Orfali is Professor for Arabic and Near Eastern Languages at the American University of Beirut in Lebanon.
Hi Bilal, how are you?
Hi Julia, I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. What's the current situation in Lebanon now with Corona?
It's difficult, like in so many other countries. We're required, of course, to put face masks in public. For example, in the supermarket, there was a total lockdown for a while, but now cars are allowed on the road based on odd even license plates. So, for example, I can drive on Monday, Wednesday, Friday to go to a supermarket or to go to my office, for example. The airport is, of course, closed. Only special flights to bring back Lebanese living abroad are allowed. Lebanon, of course, has been suffering from a financial crisis even before the pandemic because of the October Revolution. So things are much worse now, but life continues. What's the situation in Germany? Do people have to wear face masks, for example?
Yes. So currently, we see the contagion rate going down slowly, but Germany has been in the lockdown since the middle of March, and the restrictions are only slowly lifted since the end of April. So now shops and even restaurants are opening again. Also, children are returning to schools and nurseries, but very slowly, and universities have switched to virtual teaching. And then also most research libraries have still not opened their reading rooms, which is a very difficult situation for anyone wishing to finish a book, which I'm doing at the moment. I'm off teaching. I have a research grant. I want to finish my book, but I have very restricted access to libraries. And then also the crisis has aggravated social and gender inequalities clearly. Now, as to face masks, people have to wear them in shops, in public transport, and other public places. And that's interesting because that was something that was still hotly debated in March and April.
Do you think there was a debate about such a thing? This wasn't in Lebanon at all.
Interesting. So as I've argued also in an article for the Swiss blog Geschichte der Gegenwart, History of the Present, I think part of this rejection was actually rooted in a deep-seated suspicion of facial covering, which we have had in Europe since the 19th century. So in recent years, for instance, Germany has witnessed debates about Islamic forms of face covering, which were mostly driven by the far political right. But if you look into travel writing on Western Asia and North Africa, you can see that this discourse draws on a much longer tradition. So, for instance, 19th century Western travelers like Mark Twain compared women in full body veils to ghosts or dead bodies. And this was also an impression conveyed by early studio photography from the region. It's interesting because a century ago, in the 18th century, the views were still quite different. So, for instance, you have Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, the wife of the British ambassador to Constantinople, who had a very different perspective on facial veiling, because she argued that women used this anonymity for actually expanding their sexual agency. Now, of course, this is also a super generalizing perspective, but it's a completely different one than the one you have from the 19th century onwards, where people actually think that covering your face robs you of your individuality and also robs you of your freedom.
So how did this suspicion of facial covering develop in Europe?
It's actually quite puzzling because there is a history of face covering in Europe. So during masquerades and carnivals, masks allowed women to shed moral constraints for a while. In a medical context, there was also the use of masks in a military context, you have the armor worn by knights in the Middle Ages, which often covered the face in its entirety. Also, you had special kinds of masks for upper-class women to protect their complexion in the sun. And then still in the 19th century, you have the use of veils by women in marriage, in church, during burials, in mourning. You also have the emergence of masks for swimming and diving, and of course, during World War I, for protection from poison gas. But what brings all these forms of face coverage together is that they were worn temporarily, or they were only worn by a certain group within society, whereas the majority of society remained unveiled. I think facial covering became suspect to 19th century observers because visibility was a core aspect of the modern state in Europe. So you have the development of criminological photography, you have the development of the passport, and then far more recent things like the introduction of the prohibition of disguise, which is actually laid down in German law, and then, of course, the development of CCTV and facial recognition. So visibility is really core to the modern state. That's the one thing. The other thing that also is that also the idea of the individual and individual freedom became quite central to societies that considered themselves liberal and secular. So there was this idea that the individual was to act autonomously, that it was not to be restricted in its liberty unless that liberty infringed upon the liberty of others. In practice, of course, this individual was often male, middle class and white, and other groups within society had far more limits imposed upon their agency. But this did not taint the idea of individual freedom as the core ideal of modern societies. And this liberty, of course, included the liberty of dress. So facial covering from the 19th century onwards came to be associated more and more with the cultural other. And masks became objects of fascination as long as they were from Africa, Asia, and the Pacific. They inspired modern painting, sculpture, and photography. But in Europe and America itself, facial covering became more and more absent. Even headgear, which had been a sign of respectability once, was used less and less. And showing your face became tantamount to communicating authenticity and honesty. So this is actually an interesting topic that I delved into during the pandemic. And I thought that was actually a good opportunity of this kind of retreat that we were having, that you could actually think about new research topics. And I was quite intrigued to see that you have also discovered new research topics. I hope we can talk about this in a minute. And I just wanted to say, I've also decided to do a little bit of historical research on pandemics, just like you, apparently. So yeah, I'll be curious to hear more about that.
Very interesting, Julia. So tell me a little bit more about this research related to past pandemics, because I'm doing the same right now. Are there lessons, for example, that we can learn from history that are useful for us today?
I think so. So what I'm doing is I'm planning a picture book for young adults on the global biography of the plague together with a friend of mine, Samnath Banerjee, who's an Indian illustrator living in Berlin. And we are going to focus particularly on the social and cultural transformations that the plague brought about, such as the shutting down of bathhouses, the regulation of sexuality, the persecution of religious minorities. And I think what we can learn from pandemics in history is to be cautious, but not lose our heads. So it's important to be reasonable, it's important to do your research and act upon it, but you should not give in to fear and suspicion. I think that's the main thing.
Interesting, thank you.
So you are a specialist on Sufism. What can the history of Sufism tell us about how we should confront the challenge of the pandemic?
Sufis talk about reflection and self-reflection all the time. These are two major themes in Sufism. So for example, Sufis would ask what brought the current situation, how am I going to deal with it, and what kind of a person do I want to be after it. This, in Sufi terms, is a bala, a trial. It's an opportunity to polish the mirror of our hearts to become better humans. Because of the pandemic, many of us were forced to stay home and alone for a long period of time. And some of us felt lonely, for example. So Sufis in general cherish being alone. It's a good thing. An important concept in Sufism is khalwa, solitude. In some way, it derives from the idea of being alone or withdrawing from the world. Traditionally, a disciple stays in isolation for 40 days, during which he or she performs extensive spiritual exercises under the direction of a Sufi master or alone. The first few days are the most difficult, and I guess many of us experienced this during the pandemic. The first few days were the most difficult. because you were forced to leave your routine. You were left with yourself and with nothing to do, with no plan. You were left to face your thoughts and concerns. Eventually, Sufism teaches us that you will learn to control these thoughts, to forget the past and not worry about the future, and to focus on the current moment. Sufis throughout centuries wrote treatises and works about the practice of khalwa. It's a common theme in Sufism. These works are full of lessons for all the individuals in solitude in the current global crisis. They teach us how to calm down and enjoy solitude, how to restore our mental health, how to even breathe, come up with productive schedules, and to connect with ourselves and the divine in these times of disconnection.
That's very interesting. It, of course, also shows how Sufism was maybe part of a global religious dialogue. At least some of the ideas resonate with what I know from South Asia. So were you able to use some of the lessons of Sufism in your personal approach to the crisis?
Absolutely. At the beginning, I think I read something online, you know, advising me to watch movies, Netflix, etc. And I did that. I followed this advice. But then after a few days, I felt that this was not fulfilling. This was not what I was meant to do during this time of crisis. And then I remembered Shafi'i saying, so Shafi'i was not a Sufi, right? He was a jurist, but he was in contact with the Sufis at his time. And he said that he benefited two things from the Sufis, two matters. The first is time is a sword. If you do not cut it, then it will cut you into pieces. And the second, if you don't preoccupy yourself with the truth, then you will be preoccupied with falsehood. So after a few days, I realized that this is going to last for a while. It's not going to be a few days. So I decided to exercise more. I started yoga. I baked. I have not done this, Julia, in a long time. I gave cakes to my neighbors because I couldn't eat all the cakes that I was baking. And this helped us connect people living in the same building. I'm a frequent traveler, and my neighbors barely saw me or even talked to me. They didn't even know my name. Now I feel I know my neighbors well, and they know me. And it's a nice feeling. Now I meditate more. I switched to reading than watching the Netflix series, for example. Reading books that I collected for years, hoping to have the time to read them. Well, now is the time. If not now, then when? So I read so many novels. I switched off my screens and opened my books. I tried to finish papers that I'm writing, read chapters by my students, etc. I also decided to learn a new skill. I now know how to use Movie Maker.
So how has the coronavirus actually affected your research? And what's the situation like at your university, the American University of Beirut?
Right. This is a major concern, to be honest. I personally wasn't able to write longer pieces. I stopped working on my book because I thought it needs different times, basically. I wasn't ready to write this longer piece. But I finished many articles. I did much mechanical work, working on indices, taking notes, etc. And this formed like a meditation for me. I also started the youth series a few months ago. Now I'm focusing more on it because I realized that also children and young readers need meaningful books to read. So I'm also working more on that right now. Now, the situation at my university is a little bit difficult. Actually, the university is facing major problems, not because of the pandemic, but also because of the financial crisis in Lebanon. So the UB president a few weeks ago sent a message to the community that was alarming. He sent it to the staff and the faculty of the university. And it was a very honest letter. And he explained that the university is exploring steps to undertake in these times of crisis. These are not clear. The steps are not clear yet, but they may well include the closure of a number of programs and departments. In my department, for example, we canceled most, if not all, our conferences and activities for next year because we want to save money in order not to lose good people because protecting the staff is the most important thing right now.
That's terrible. I'm very sorry to hear that. It's very concerning. Of course, we do have debates about how academia is going to suffer from the pandemic. I think it will suffer in a number of ways, but I think a private university is facing even bigger problems. And of course, I mean, AUB is a very renowned university, and it would be terrible if it really had to make these cuts. So in the current situation, I think we see globally that research from the sciences is deemed more relevant by governments and the general public. So do you think that humanity is actually more under threat in such a context? And how can we actually, as scholars from the humanities, counter such simple assumptions?
Right, Julia, absolutely. Unfortunately, many people look at humanities as a luxury. It's something nice to have. It's important, but it's a plus, because the benefit from it is not immediate in their opinion. Humanities programs are often the first to suffer in times of crisis. I see it in my university these days. But we forget that mental health is as important as physical health. I, for example, could not have survived the last 3 months without my books. I could have survived without medication, but not without my books. Any approach to survive the current pandemic that does not look at the problem from all aspects of life is not going to be effective, in my opinion. Can we just focus on medications and ignore the ethical, political, social, and historical dimension? You know, we take ethical questions in hospitals every day. Not to mention, of course, the artistic and literary dimension. I recently started reading about pandemics in human history as well, and particularly in Islamic history. Many people would be surprised by the similarities to our current times and about what history can teach us in these times of crisis. I stumbled upon fascinating texts by pre-modern Arab historians and physicians connecting pandemics to air pollution and mistreating nature, for example. There is a fascinating text by Ibn Khaldun and another by Lisanuddin Ibn al-Khatib from Al-Andalus about this. I'm so lucky to be an AGIA member, as I quickly applied to Research Tandem to explore this further. At this challenging time for research and budget cuts in my university, AGIA provided me with an opportunity to research the topic that is so timely and overlooked.
I'll be curious to hear more about that in another place. So how has actually your work life changed during the pandemic? Your life in teaching and supervising graduate students and so on?
As an academic, I have suffered like all other academics in the world, I think. So we stay at home. We don't have access to the campus or to our own offices. We don't even have access to our libraries in our offices, let alone the university libraries and the public libraries and the archives. I had to learn to teach online and do meetings online. I'm a chair of a department, and this was totally new to me. I have never taught online before. I have never even used Zoom or Microsoft Teams before. My conferences, workshops, lectures, and activities all got canceled. I lost access to the university library. I had to think carefully about what matters to me, right? How am I going to spend my research time? I tried personally to focus on my graduate students, my research, and my outreach activities. I'm trying to post a movie about research, about my research, once a week. So as I said, I learned how to use Movie Maker. I'm more in touch with my graduate students now. I was always a hands-on advisor, but as a chair of a department, you have to meet so many students every day, and so many people want to talk about the program, about conferences, activities, meetings on campus, etc. I think I saved a lot of time because most of the meetings were really not necessary. They were a plus, or they could have been done over the phone or over Zoom or etc. So I teach my classes via Zoom. I had to learn how to run debates and go over readings via Zoom, but also I scheduled one-to-one meetings with these graduate students to talk about their difficult times, about their dissertations, their theses, their times in Lebanon, or if they had to relocate abroad. Now, of course, online teaching gives you also this, that people can join from different places in the world, right? Even if they're not on campus. So that's a good thing. So I think I connected well with my graduate students during these times of crisis. Have you tried to participate in online workshops and conferences, Julia? What was your experience?
Yes, I have actually done that. So my situation was a bit similar to yours, maybe, in that I also lost access to libraries. This slowed down my work considerably and that was not good at all, because I'm currently under big pressure to finish my second book. Without the second book, I won't get a permanent job, and jobs are also getting more and more rare at the moment in academia in Germany. So I had time also for some other things, for some side projects, and for actually participating in some online workshops. So, for instance, I was able to participate in a conference on the history of pandemics at the University of Harvard, which, of course, otherwise would have been a huge trip, a time-consuming and expensive trip. And I could attend this conference, which was very interesting for the side project that I'm doing at the moment. And then I'm also practicing photography in the little spare time that I have. So I attended two online classes at the International Center for Photography in New York on photography in confinement. I'd always wanted to do a class with them, but again, I mean, it's a huge time investment normally, traveling to New York and, you know, buying a flight, etc. So these events were most inspiring. It was great to participate in them. But I do have to say that it's easier to follow and stay focused if you are attending an event physically. And I think direct encounters are also far more interactive. So in the long run, I don't think we will be able to do without them. And I also hope that this will not be a consequence of the pandemic, that actually conference funding is going to be cut, because the argument is going to be, well, you can all do this virtually. You can't. You can do some of it virtually, but not all of it, I think.
Right, I agree. What is your experience giving online classes to the students? Have you embraced virtual learning?
Well, as I mentioned in the beginning of this talk, I currently have a research grant to finish my second book, and so I'm off teaching. Mm. But I do expect to be giving online classes, or return maybe to forms of blended teaching in winter, because, of course, everyone suspects that there will be a second wave of the pandemic in winter. Yeah, I think online classes are a good supplement, and they allow students to repeat a lesson or to take it at a time convenient to them. But there's also a certain risk involved, because the trend towards virtual learning should not increase precarity among non-tenured faculty.
Right. So what are your concerns as an academic in Germany today?
On the one hand, I see a certain threat to the humanities, as we discussed already, that the humanities will simply be considered less and less relevant, that they will receive less public attention unless maybe you do research on pandemics, right? And the other threat I see is that, of course, the state is doing a lot at the moment to support the economy, even actually to support the arts and the cultures, at least in Berlin. This is quite remarkable. So there has been financial help for artists from the beginning of this pandemic, which is a wonderful thing. But I think in the end, universities are going to suffer to some extent. And already before the pandemic, the situation was like, you know, one or two maybe permanent positions coming up a year to which you could apply, to which maybe 100 other people applied, and then one person got the job. And this is not going to get any better, I think.
Right, I agree.
But maybe, you know, let's talk about the positive effects of this whole thing. Do you think the pandemic can have positive effects on society and academic work, more specifically?
Yeah, I think working from home will become more common worldwide. This will save us some time, and it will mean different things to people who have children, for example, or have families, yes, or work in remote places. This is an opportunity also to reflect on ways to teach and do research. Online teaching has become a reality, I think, and blended learning could be the future. There are articles about Earth healing, and this is very important, and I hope this is true. Earth is our home, and this home cleaning is overdue, I think. I hope the world governments will realize how we are all connected. Something that happens in China have direct consequences in refugee camps, for example, in Lebanon, but also on tourists in Spain and Germany. So we're all connected, and we should use this to build a better future for humanity.
Yes, I agree. I think this is a very good final sentence for our conversation. I've enjoyed it a lot, because one of the things I actually miss most in the current situation is to have a good talk and a deeper talk with people I would normally see more often in a year. So thank you a lot for this. And I hope you'll be well. And please, you know, let's stay in touch about our research and everything else.
Same here, Julia. I hope we will meet soon in an AGIA conference or an AGIA workshop. or any other opportunity. So thank you again. I very much enjoyed this conversation as well. Goodbye.
Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the podcast, Agia Goes Viral. You can find all of the podcast episodes on our website, agia.info. That's agya.info. Until next time, please stay healthy and safe.